for setting up the series and this incredible lunch, which I understand is not referenced in the title of, you know, eating kosher and kosher venue and all that. I want to thank Laura for her help in copying the papers. I saw her. Here she go. Okay.
Get it out.
Okay. In general, when I speak on practical topics, I always tell people, ask your shul rabbi for actual psak, for a ruling on a specific situation. Last year when we did the series, we basically dealt with ethical topics, and that was easier to do without issuing a psak. On this, it's a little bit harder. But really, last word on practical halach issues must go with the shul rabbi, so anything I say should be double-checked to determine community practice. The case that I want to deal with is the case of a business lunch in which the key is to attend rather than to eat, because a person could theoretically eat before and eat after. And the reason I give that caveat is because when we talk about some of the practical questions of what I may and may not eat, I'm not assuming that a person who fails to eat is going to starve. It's not the situation of, can I eat this bread because it's the last bread on earth? I can eat in advance, I can eat later on. It's much more an issue of comfort and, you know, concern for appearances and issues like that. This is not a starvation discussion. And that's important to note. I'll begin with the story of a fellow. I'm going to make up a name for him because, you know, I don't embarrass anybody. His name is Ralph Schwartz. No Ralph Schwartzes. No one related to a Ralph Schwartz. So Ralph Schwartz goes into a Chinese restaurant, and it's not a kosher restaurant, and his rabbi sees him and can't believe what he's seeing, and so he walks up to the glass and he looks inside and he sees Ralph is sitting there, and Ralph opening up the menu and ordering some food, and it's brought out, and it turns out to be like spare ribs or whatever else he's going to order in this restaurant, and he actually sees him sit down and take out the cutlery and cut a piece and put it in his mouth, and he can't stop himself. He runs into the restaurant and he says, "Ralph, what are you doing?" And Ralph turns to him and says, "Rabbi, what's wrong? Didn't you see me? Didn't you see me come into the restaurant?" And he says, "Yes." He says, "Didn't you see me open the menu?" He says, "Yes." "And didn't you see me order the food?" "Yes." "And didn't you see that it was brought to the table?" "Yes." "And didn't you see me eat?" He says, "Yes." He says, "Well then, Rabbi, what's the problem? It was all under rabbinical supervision." There are a few jokes like that, but that's the one I chose for today. I can tell you some more later. One of the major issues that we deal with when we talk about eating kosher in a non-kosher restaurant, eating kosher at a non-kosher business lunch, at a party, whatever the case may be, is an issue that we call in Hebrew Maris Ayin. It's a matter of appearances. So what I want to do actually is tackle that first. In the first scenario, let's assume you can get kosher food, but you're sitting in a non-kosher venue, and the issue is appearances, because not everybody who sees you knows that you're eating kosher food. So that's issue number one. Then, issue number two, you can't get a special kosher meal, and you come to whatever it is, and they have platters out in front of them. What is a person actually allowed to eat at that at that restaurant, in that venue? What could a person partake of? But the first question, again, is the issue of Maris Ayin, an issue of appearances. We are taught, it's a Gemara in Shabbos, that a Jew must be concerned for the appearance of his actions, and even when he's in private, he must be concerned about the appearance of his actions. If you take a look at source number one, this is from Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, the author of Chafetz Chaim and Mishneh Berurah, writing about 100 years ago in Poland about this issue of concern for what people are going to think. And he quotes two earlier authorities, Tosfot and the Rosh authorities from Europe from the 13th century, saying that this, meaning the concern that someone might see me doing something and think that I'm violating the law, is only where there is a concern that observers might suspect him of violating biblical law, then it is prohibited even in private. In other words, just because I excerpted a section, it's not so clear, I didn't give you the full context. But what he's saying is that if someone who sees me might think I was violating biblical law, I can't do whatever action it is, even in private, where no one can see me. Doesn't make a difference. If it is prohibited only rabbinically, if what they think I might be doing is prohibited rabbinically, then it's only in public that I'm not allowed to do it. Okay? Either way, whether it's rabbinic or biblical, if someone could see me and think I'm violating the law, then I'm not allowed to do whatever action it is. So, in our discussion, I am sitting at I'm sitting in a restaurant at a business meeting, and they bring me my kosher meal. They arranged a kosher meal for me. It comes in front of me at the table, and they have plasticware or whatever they have, so I'm not using the silverware, and all the food was double wrapped and triple wrapped and quadruple wrapped, and everything is fine. There's someone passing by the restaurant outside who sees me sitting there, and he knows me, and he knows I keep kosher. And he can't see that I have special food. Do I need to be concerned that he's going to think that I'm in fact eating non-kosher food? That would be one consideration. Or maybe he doesn't know me, but he sees that I'm wearing a yarmulke. He says, oh, there's a Jew in there wearing a yarmulke. It must be okay. This must be all right. And now he's going to go in and buy there. So there are really two separate concerns in this. One concern is the one I just mentioned, that people might think it's permitted. People might think this restaurant is a kosher restaurant. The second concern is that people might think I'm a bad guy. They may know the restaurant is not kosher, but they may think I am flouting the law. That's also a concern. You know, we live in a society in which the norm is to say, who cares? It's not their business what I'm doing, and why do I have to worry about their opinion of me? But classically, within Judaism, that's not so. If you take a look at source number two, the context is actually one that should interest accountants. It's a discussion about tithing shkalim, tithing the donations to the Beis HaMikdash. What happens is in the temple, everybody donated a half shekel coin. The coins were stored in a special area called a lishka, it's a kind of office, and three times during the course of the year, a kohen, a priest, would go into the room and would separate coins for actual use of the temple, to buy offerings, to work on the building itself, to pay craftsmen, whatever they're going to do with those coins. So when he walked into the room, he had to follow a whole set of rules. For example, he was not allowed to wear clothing that had pockets. He was not allowed to wear shoes, because he might be hiding some in his shoes. He couldn't wear clothing that had a seam, because, again, maybe there's a stitch that's open, he's hiding something in the seam. He had to talk to somebody constantly as he was in there, lest someone think he was hiding coins in his mouth. There was this concern. There was even a suggestion in the Talmud Yerushalmi, they suggest maybe he should have his mouth full of water, and that way you would know he couldn't put a coin inside. But then they worry he might swallow some and he didn't make a bracha. I'm not kidding, that's the discussion there. There's a concern that people might think he's doing something inappropriate. So take a look at source number two, in which the sages explain why we go this far. Adam tzarech latzeis yidei habrios. One must satisfy others just as one must satisfy God. That's a high standard, right? It's not just other people shouldn't think bad of you. But the same way you have to satisfy the divine judge, you have to satisfy other people also. And they quote two biblical passages. One is, Ve'yisem nikiyam Hashem u'Yisrael, you shall be innocent in the eyes of God and Israel, meaning it's your obligation to make sure you're innocent in the eyes of God and Israel. And the second sentence, Ve'umatzachen v'seichaltav b'nei Elokim v'adam, find favor and a reputation for good insight in the eyes of God and man. This is an imperative, that we are supposed to strive to develop a good reputation, that no one should think that we would do something inappropriate. Given that that's so, how would one be permitted, in fact, to go into a non-kosher restaurant and get a kosher meal ordered? How could that actually be appropriate? How could it be allowed? So There is grounds to argue it should be permitted for two reasons. If you take a look at source number three, you see one reason. This is from a discussion Talmudically about the laws of Shabbat. If a person has a gutter that drains his roof and stuff builds up inside the gutter, as it backs up, the water is going to find other places to leak out and can potentially cause damage to the house. either it will end up leaking around the base of it, and now it can cause the foundation to be weakened, or the roof itself. And remember that in Talmudic times, you had a flat roof, and people used the roof, and the rooftop, this flat surface, may be lined with clay or pitch or whatever it is, but ultimately, if you leave water on there long enough, it's going to find a way in. So a person realizes on Shabbat, in the middle of a rainstorm, that his gutter is blocked. Well, if you unblock it, you're fixing something. You can't fix things on Shabbat. So what may you do? Take a look at source number 3. Nachum Ishgalia Omer. Nachum Ishgalia said, if obstructive material builds up in a pipe, one may crush it with his foot in private without concern. Meaning, he uses the back of his foot to kind of like his heel, you know, he'll use to press down on the stuff that's at the base of the pipe, and that way it'll allow the water to flow. And as for your concerns about the laws of Shabbat, he's fixing it only abnormally, because he's using the back of his foot to do it. And the sages did not decree in a case of loss. To prevent loss, he's allowed to violate. No, it's not violate. They're telling you that the rabbinic prohibition will not apply. The rabbinic prohibition against fixing this in this abnormal way will not apply. And I'm not concerned for appearances either, to avoid loss. So if a person is in a situation in which he says, you know what? I don't want to go to the non-kosher restaurant where they're having this business meeting. And if I don't go, then they're going to look badly on me at work, and I have a review coming up, and what are they going to say about me, and am I going to be able to keep my job? That's potential loss. And therefore, there's grounds for leniency. Mind you, I think, yeah, I don't know the climate in Toronto. I know the climate in a few other places. And I think it varies very much place by place. In New York, there's really no reason that you can't be able to hold the meal in a kosher place. And people know that as a general rule at the businesses. They understand Judaism and keeping kosher and all that is part of the atmosphere. You go to other places, it's not necessarily so. I don't know what the situation is. I imagine it'll vary by business. I'm guessing at Zeifman's this is not such an issue. But at other businesses, it may well be. So the concern that one might have for being able to keep his job is a legitimate concern. The second reason why we have grounds for leniency is found in source number 4, a commentary on the Code of Jewish Law. And the context is a discussion about what one may or may not do because of appearances, concern for how people are going to interpret what one is doing. And source number 4, this commentator called the Pri Chadash, he says, the Rashba's prohibition against cooking meat in human milk because of appearances. We know that Judaism says you're not allowed to cook meat and milk together. That we understand. That doesn't apply biblically to human milk. However, there's a rabbinic concern. Rabbi Shlomo ben Aderet, writing in the 14th century, says, don't cook meat in human milk either, because someone looking on doesn't know what kind of milk this is. So he says, that's a novelty, and let us not add to it. We should not expand any further, he says. We should not decree and prohibit on our own because of appearances other than the cases explained in the Talmud. And so wrote Tosfot that we should not compare the sages' decrees other than where the Talmud does. So he says, I'm not going to invent new cases of maris ayin, of appearances. If a case is mentioned in the Talmud as, don't do this because of what it's going to look like. So for example, if you have wet clothing, you're not supposed to put it out to dry where you leave laundry out to dry on Shabbat, because people might think you did laundry on Shabbat. That's an example that's mentioned in the Talmud. But this, he says, you know, to start expanding beyond that, he says, we don't do that. If it's there in the Talmud, it counts. If it's not there in the Talmud, it doesn't. This is subject to some dispute, but it's a potential grounds for leniency also to say, well, you know what, the non-kosher business lunch wasn't mentioned in the Talmud. It wasn't in the discussion, so therefore, there's no reason for me to add it. So, again, what we've said so far is there is a concern, theoretically, about appearances and not doing things which people can misinterpret. But we do have two reasons to be lenient. One, to avoid loss, and the other, the fact that this isn't mentioned Talmudically. So the fellow goes into the restaurant. They order the kosher food on his behalf. He does have room for leniency. However, with the caveat that he still should make sure to take every step possible to avoid misleading people. And this was the ruling of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein one of the leading authorities in Jewish law in the second half of the 20th century, in source number 5, talks about going into a restaurant where one is very, very hungry. He's not talking about a business meeting. He just says a person has no way to get kosher food. He's starving. He's driving along the highway and he just needs to get something. And the only thing they have are these rest stops, which have a McDonald's or whatever it is. And he wants to go in and get a soda. So what may he do? So Ramosha writes in source number 5, even entering to eat foods known to be free of any concern is prohibited due to appearances and suspicion. But if one is especially hungry, such that he is in great pain, and there is no other place to eat, one may enter and eat food known to be permitted. But this must be in private. Well, what does that mean? How is it going to be private? You're in the middle of McDonald's. So he expands. Let me just finish the quote. He says, the sages did not decree in cases of pain or loss. So he expands in the rest of his responsum to explain what he means by private. He says, if there's anyone around who knows you or who will recognize you as Jewish, then you are responsible to actually tell them, I'm only having the soda. That's his definition of public. If anyone would recognize you as a Jew, then you would be obligated to say to them, I'm only having the soda. Now, this creates the potential comical scenario, you know, of the Jew, you know, at the rest stop, you know, walking around to the tables and saying, excuse me, are you Jewish? You should know I just had the soda. Excuse me, are you Jewish? Some question, maybe a person should take off his yarmulke in such a situation so that people will be less aware that he's a Jew. No chai necklace and all that. And in fact, I have seen those who have suggested that. But it's very controversial because then it raises a whole new set of problems. Eating and making a bracha without a yarmulke on and so on. It's not simple and straightforward. Yes?
So you're pretty much, so according to what you're saying now, anytime, like if a person wants to go into a store that is in the kosher, say like at the baseball game, go and just get a drink, you're saying you have to be really, really thirsty and really be in pain before you can actually go and...
Right. So the answer is not necessarily, because of one more caveat on this ruling of Rav Moshe. I've seen contemporary authorities who suggest that the concern for appearances has to be bounded by logic. No one is going to think that I went into McDonald's and had a cheeseburger. That's not realistic. Number one, because everybody knows McDonald's isn't kosher. And number two, it's a given that observant Jews don't eat cheeseburgers. And if they do, it's not in a restaurant. So because of that, because those are social givens, anybody who sees me knows full well I'm there for a soda, that I'm not there for a cheeseburger. The question really will come up where you have a borderline situation. You have a restaurant which some people think is kosher and some people know really is not kosher. It has perhaps a supervision that's not a recognized supervision, or it's vegetarian, and some people are of the mindset that if it's vegetarian, then everything must be okay. That sort of a thing. Where there's room for doubt, that's really where this comes into play. Where it's obvious. So I'm at the hot dog stand at the ballpark. Everybody knows I'm not there to get the hot dog, that I'm just there to get the soda. I would probably avoid going over to a stand which has a brand of hot dog which some people think is kosher and some people think is not, and I'm on video, and therefore I am not going any further than that. If there is a brand that some people think is kosher and some people think is not, so I'm not going to go over there and get a soda lest people think that I'm having the hot dog. That's true. So that's one. The other possibility for how I can protect myself is found in source number 6. And this works for most places where you're going to get your kosher meal ordered. The Ramah Rav Moshe Isserles, writing in Shulchan Aruch on the Code of Jewish Law, says, people make almond milk and put poultry in it. Since, I added in the words, even were it real milk, it would only be rabbinically prohibited. There's no concern if I have almond milk with poultry about what people are going to see, because after all, I'm doing it in my house. And we said that what you do in private is okay if the concern is only for the appearance of a rabbinic violation. And then he says, however, for beef, so it's now would be biblical, one should put almonds beside the milk because of appearances. If you have almond milk, let the world know it's almond milk. So when they first came out with real pyro creamer, so people would keep the container out on the table so that everybody would know this is pyro creamer that's there in the coffee that I'm drinking at my meat meal. And that changes over time in terms of what people will understand intuitively and what they won't understand intuitively. When Shabbos clocks first came out, right, people were able to use timers to turn lights on and off. There was a great concern. Many authorities did not want to permit it because not everybody will realize that when they see the light go on in my house, it's because the timer turned it on. Today, I think probably most observant Jews are very comfortable using a Shabbos clock for all sorts of things. Because they say, you know what, everybody knows that this was done by a timer, I wasn't the one who did this. So the point is then, going back to our kosher meal in the non-kosher restaurant, if you leave out the wrapping, right, that says Wilton Foods or whatever it is, so everybody knows it isn't restaurant food, then you will be assuring yourself that you have no concern for appearances because everybody can tell what this is and what this isn't. So to sum up this portion of things, we do have a concern for appearances when you're eating at a non-kosher place. We do have grounds for leniency to avoid loss. So one who needs to would be able to do so. He should make sure not to mislead people. And the concern for appearances altogether only applies in the event that you might really be misleading people. In the event that it's going to be clear to the onlooker, that's not Maris Hayin, that's not an issue of appearances. Okay. That brings us to the second half. And the second half is, okay, they didn't order kosher food for me. Now what do I do? I'm at the party, I'm at the meeting, I'm at whatever it is. What am I now supposed to do? So, leaving aside other issues of holiday parties, by the way, which I want to get to next week, in the third week. But in general, one of the classics is fruit. Everyone says, "Well, okay, just go have the fruit, and then you'll be fine." And generally speaking, that's going to be true. Generally speaking, that's going to be true. One needs to be concerned when dealing with fruit that might have infestation. I brought you there the classic source in source number 7 from the Talmud that identifies different types of insects, some of which fly, some of which crawl, some of which swim, and the violations involved in eating one of those. So we avoid that if the fruit might be infested. The classic ones these days when you're dealing with fruit tend to be blackberries, strawberries, raspberries. Those tend to be a concern, whereas other fruits tend not to be an issue, but it really changes based on time and place. In Europe of 60 years ago, they were cutting open cherries to look for worms inside. It really depends on where you live and what the quality of the produce is and how it's stored. Very important to know just in general. With produce, it's not always the way it grows that's the concern. It's with how they're storing it at the supermarket that will determine whether you have to worry or not. What if I go to the restaurant then and I get fruit? Do I have to be concerned that they sliced it up using their non-kosher knife, the knife that had been used for other things? So take a look on the flip side, please. It's source number 8. A line from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. Ambiguous utensils of non-Jews, stam klei ovdei kochavim, as it is in the Hebrew, meaning utensils which may have been used today for non-kosher food or may not have been used today for non-kosher food, I don't know. So they may be assumed to have not been used that day. The reason for that is because I am in doubt. I don't know that they were used today. And even if they were used today, maybe they are clean, maybe the taste wasn't absorbed in them. So I can assume they weren't used that day. Therefore, if they were used before kashering, meaning they were used to cut my food before kashering, then the food is permitted. Let me explain a little bit more about the same day issue, because I realize I should have unpacked that more. When you're dealing in kashrut, there's a concern for, obviously, non-kosher food getting into kosher food, but there's a separate concern for absorption. And that is that if I use a knife to cut non-kosher food, some of the taste from the non-kosher food is absorbed in the knife. I then use that knife to cut kosher food. Potentially, the taste is extruded into my new food. Or I have a spoon that was used for hot soup that wasn't kosher, and then I use that spoon for my soup that is kosher. But again, the taste of the non-kosher soup is extruded into my kosher soup. do I have to have such a concern then when I use their utensils? So in the event that the last use, in the event that there was a 24-hour gap after the non-kosher use, then any taste that is absorbed in the food is in the utensil is said to be negative. It deteriorated already. And therefore it cannot be said to render my food non-kosher. Even if it does get into my food is still okay. That was clear? I hope. Okay.
How can you assume, though?
Right.
That it wasn't used. I mean, you don't know that.
Correct. I'm going to come back to that in 1 second. Good point. So theoretically, if it was used for non-kosher that day, then that non-kosher food could be a part of what I'm eating now. If I'm willing to make the assumption that it wasn't used that day, though, then that means that whatever taste was in it is now a negative taste, and therefore isn't said to affect my food at all. That's the theory. Now, can you really make such an assumption? No? Why not?
I don't think so. I wouldn't do it.
Because? On what grounds? Just because it's uncomfortable?
No, it's because I was raised that way. You don't know.
Right. So the
problem, if it's around, there'd be a countervailing assumption. This is not a case of an individual, but this is a case where these tools are being used all the time.
Right. So we have two points that are being raised. One, can you really do that? And number two, is it logical to do that? So in terms of the can you really do that, in the eyes of the law, the answer is yes. Because the doubt is a distant doubt. Because even if it was used within the past 24 hours, whatever it was used for, there may be some absorption inside the utensil, but maybe it's nullified in the greater mix of the food. It may be insignificant in terms of the ratio. And it may not be able to affect the food that I'm eating. On the other hand, from a practical perspective, it may not be so. The argument is that in restaurants, they constantly use their stock of equipment. It's not in the best interest of the restaurant to have equipment that's not in use. They don't want to invest in it. And therefore, the argument goes on a practical level, you may not be able to say this. So that's a key point. But continue in source number 8, because more than that...
On the other hand, the restaurant rarely will use a meat knife to cut fruit.
Hang in there. I'm going to come back to that point. He finishes the line by saying, however, one may not tell a non-Jew, cook vegetables for me in your pot. This is what we call a bidyeved. It's an after-the-fact argument, meaning it's not that I can go into the restaurant and order food saying, well, their vessels were not used that day anyway, probably. It's only that if I have food that was cut with his knife, and now I don't want to throw out the food, one argument to justify not throwing it out is, well, the utensils weren't used the same day. But it doesn't permit me initially to go ahead and say, use your knife to cut something for me. So that's a key factor against making the argument of, well, it probably wasn't used that day. That plus the fact that it may well have been used. Now, David raises the question of, maybe the facility is careful about keeping the meat and their dairy separate and their fruit and separate from their, or not the meat and the dairy, but the meat and the fruit separate in terms of equipment use. So it depends a lot on facility. It depends on quality of the restaurant.
Yeah.
But I can tell you, as someone who ran a VOD, we had a supermarket that wanted to have its fruit platters certified by us. And they would regularly take knives from behind their deli counter over to the fruit station to cut fruit if the knives at the fruit station, whatever, weren't available, someone was busy and they had a big order to do, whatever it was. So you have to know the facility. It's a reality question. It's not a question of halacha. It's what's going on behind the counter, and you really need to know before applying the rules. So going back to the fruit then, if I'm not allowed to rely on this assumption that utensils weren't used the same day, am I allowed to even have the sliced fruit? The answer is yes. Because the assumption is that the knife was clean of residue beforehand, and fruit, generally speaking, is considered soft in the eyes of Jewish law, and therefore, any taste absorbed in the knife is not said to be extruded into the fruit. notable exceptions exist. There may be a hard fruit, like a pineapple or something like that, for which this may be a concern, but as a general rule, sliced fruit, if it's not of the buggy varieties, is going to be fine. That's one. What about vegetables? So again, you'd have to avoid the buggy ones. The classic ones seem to be the green leaves, the broccoli, cauliflower, artichoke, anything that kids don't like, would be avoided. Also, potentially onion and radish should be avoided. And the reason for onion and radish being avoided is the taste of onion and radish is sharp. And the rule within kashrut is that if the knife absorbed non-kosher taste even days ago, and then it's used to cut the onion or the radish, because the taste of the onion and radish are sharp, it is said to render the taste absorbed in the knife a positive taste. It improves the taste of whatever is in the knife, and therefore the non-kosher residue, the non-kosher taste that's extruded into your onion or radish is halakhically significant. In the eyes of Jewish law, it will matter. And therefore, onion and radish would be avoided. So you could order the vegetables. Just make sure to tell them not to include onion and radish as part of that. What about lemon? So the argument with lemon is an interesting one, because it's the peel that's actually hard and could cause the extrusion. The onion, the lemon inside is actually soft.
But it's not sharp.
The sharp taste discussion, it's a good question. Within citrus, most sources say that citrus is not a problem, but lemon might be. It's true. Lemon uniquely might be considered to be sharp. So if the person were to use the knife for the lemon, I could see the argument to avoid the lemon. Yeah, I could see the argument to avoid the lemon. Other citruses would be fine, but lemon should be avoided. What about the fish? People say, well, you can go in and get fish. So fish is a big problem. First of all, identifying the fish as the proper fish is a problem. People say, well, I can go to the supermarket and get tuna and it's okay. And I know that they're not going to sell me something else, because they don't want to damage their reputation if they get caught. And in fact, that's from the Shulchan Aruch. Take a look at source number 9, Code of Jewish Law, building on a concept in the Talmud itself. It says, Yain rimonim shemochrim l'refua, pomegranate wine, which is sold for medicine, may be purchased from a merchant, even absent the original barrel, which had a stamp on it or whatever it was. And even though it is more valuable than wine, such that the merchant has incentive for fraud. Right? And I might think, maybe he's going to dilute it with something that's not kosher. Don't worry about it. Since people would be upset at substitution, the merchant will not harm himself by committing fraud. So we do have the idea that professionals are worried about their reputation, and therefore you can assume that they're not going to cheat you. This comes up all the time in terms of milk, right? The idea that I could use milk and not worry about making sure that it's been under supervision. Yes, there is Chalav Yisrael, making sure that it's Jew supervised it the whole time. But major kashrut agencies, including the COR here, will certify milk that is not Chalav Yisrael, that was not certified by a Jew. Why are they not worried about adulteration with, let's say, pig's milk? The answer is because the manufacturers stand to lose a great deal of money in the event that they would be caught adulterating the milk. Now, milk is in particular suited for this argument, because it's counterproductive for them to try to mix something else in. Because it would actually cost them more to raise pigs on a dairy farm and then to actually milk the pigs and mix in the small quantity of milk that they're getting from the pig into the quantity of milk they're getting from the cow. It's illogical, it's irrational from a business perspective, aside from any issues of reputation and what would happen to them if they were caught. That doesn't necessarily exist, though, in other industries. I can't speak to the pomegranate wine industry. I have to admit that I'm maybe ask a pharmacist, since it was being used for medicine. But I can share with you this fascinating article, source number 10. This is the opening two paragraphs of the article. You can go online and find the whole thing. As part of a special fishy business series, the Boston Globe spent 5 months buying fish from dozens of establishments throughout Massachusetts and sending the samples off to a lab in Canada. DNA tests found 48% of the fish had been mislabeled as a more expensive type of fish. Fish samples were gathered from 134 restaurants, grocery stores, and seafood markets, and the results were staggering. Every one of 23 white tuna samples tested turned out to be something other than tuna. Every single sample. In most cases, the fish labeled tuna was Escalar, which the Globe said was, quote, nicknamed the Ex-Lax of fish by some in the industry for the digestion problems it can cause. Google Escalar and you'll find out more about this. Interestingly, there are actually two types of fish that are known as Escalar, one of which is a kosher fish and one of which is a non-kosher fish. But people who went to the store and said, well, they're not going to lie to me. If they say it's tuna, it's tuna. 23 out of 23 times, the answer is no. And this is common. It's not just in fish. This comes up all the time. I actually found this article by accident. I was looking for a different article. I've seen these over the years. The classic ones that people know about are like honey being adulterated with corn syrup, which is an issue for Pesach. The olive oil, which is sold as extra virgin olive oil, having other things mixed in as well. It happens all the time because they're gambling that they won't get caught. And then even if they are caught, the fine doesn't cost them as much as they can make off of this fraud. So when a person goes into the supermarket or the restaurant, as our case here, and says, well, I'll just order the fish, he has to know that he isn't necessarily getting what he thinks he's getting. Then you have concerns for how it's cooked. What is it cooked in? If it's cooked by someone who isn't Jewish, you have another issue, the law of Bishul Akum, that a Jew is not supposed to have food, that certain types of food, if they're cooked by someone who isn't Jewish, a law meant to prevent intermarriage. What if he says, I'll just get the sushi? Right? Does he have any concerns then? Well, for starters, again, how do you know what type of fish you're actually getting? Number two, you have the wrap that they use to wrap the fish. It's a seafood wrap. And that, unfortunately, has a tendency for worm infestation. I don't want to put anyone off their food. Not to mention that the rice is subject also to the law of Bishul Akum. The rice is cooked, I hope, before you have it. So even that is potentially a problem.
Salmon not a problem.
Salmon is less of a concern because salmon has a unique color. You should know there are other fish that they do that have that color. So it's not a given entirely, but it's true that salmon generally is marked by its color so much so that the salmon you buy may actually have artificial coloring. Because if it doesn't look like that, then they want to make it look like that. So, worth knowing.
The knife is an issue in the sushi place, too.
The knife theoretically can be an issue if it was used to cut non-kosher and then this also. That's true. So yes, we have fruit and vegetables. Stay away from the fish. What about bread? So, bread, you will often get a supermarket or a restaurant where they provide bread that's actually a kosher product. And then they just finish it. They just bake it off. In Allentown, Pennsylvania, the supermarket there, it was from a chain called Giant, they had a bagel that they were bringing in from New York. And it was under the supervision of the rabbi there where they produced it. And it was just coming to the supermarket and they were baking it off. There's a chain called Manhattan Bagel that was doing the same exact thing. Now, mind you, they were then, you know, making all sorts of sandwiches with it in the restaurant, but it was a kosher product initially. So would one be allowed to go into the restaurant and order this, knowing that it's a kosher product, if he, you know, knows that, if he looked into it, and then it was just baked off there? What do you think?
No.
No? Why not?
Well, who's to go with the others?
Why does it have to be lit by anybody? What do you mean? Hey, flesh that out.
Well, you have to determine that it's bread that's cooked by a Jew.
Right, so you're worried about pas yisrael, right? But remember that we do have a leniency for pas palter, to be able to use commercially baked bread.
It depends if they have just ovens to bake bread as opposed to putting it in the oven when they cook the food.
Right, is it a dedicated oven, and how careful are they about that would be one issue. Another issue is the pan. They don't want the bread to stick to the pan. And therefore, they will grease the pan. And you know what they're likely greasing the pan with. I lard something along those lines. It can be certainly an animal-shortening product. Now, I have seen rabbis rule that non-pan bread is fine. If you get hard breads, that those would actually be permitted. And I recommend, again, ask the rabbi of your shul for a ruling on that. But I have seen that as a practical ruling for people that they could use hard rolls. Another concern, by the way, that comes up is to make sure, and this is a little gross, but make sure the people who are handling it are actually not handling it with the same hands that they used, you know, to handle all their other food in the store. I was in a restaurant that was applying for hashgacha. They were applying for supervision, and they just wanted supervision on their bagels and nothing else. But the bagels, after they were baked off, were sitting in a bin in the front, and when someone went up and ordered a sandwich of whatever, the workers were not changing their gloves when they handled the bagels. They wore gloves, but they would pick up the bagel and they'd pick up the pork or whatever it was they're putting on the bagel, they would serve it, and then they would go right back to the next bagel. They weren't careful about that. So that's another issue that can come up. Okay, beverages. So generally speaking, we assume it's fine to use the glasses in the restaurant for cold drinks. That's fine. Juices would need to be 100% juice. And one should avoid the apple juice unless it has supervision, because they often mix in grape. It's still called 100% juice, but they'll often mix in, not the restaurant, they're not mixing it in, it's the producer, but they'll often use grape juice in with the apple juice.
Also, there is apple juice, it's to prevent the froth, but they also put like a slab of pork on top.
Really?
Yeah. We found that out when we were back in B.C.
Yeah. Interesting, I never knew that.
Apple juice should have an extra.
Okay, so in addition to the grape juice, we have a pork concern. So not only may it not be kosher, it may be fleshic. Coffee, of course, has recently come under fire, so to speak, with the Starbucks business of the last year and a half or so. The tendency historically was to tell people that if it's unflavored coffee, and it's from a machine that's dedicated for unflavored coffee, and you're not adding cream, you're not adding milk, you would be fine. Ideally, it would be a disposable cup, but because of concern about how they handle the equipment and what they use the equipment for, but b'di'eved, you would be able to use it even in glass because of the idea that Sfaradim follow and that Ashkenazim follow in a time of need, that glass doesn't absorb. Now there's a lot of back and forth going on about the coffee issue and whether one would be allowed to, because of concern that even the coffee maker is washed with the other equipment. I refer you to your rabbi on it. But historically, coffee was considered to be okay to get, ideally in a disposable utensil. Alcohol is another discussion, which I think I'm going to hold over until the holiday presents discussion in number three. We'll talk parties and presents there. We'll hold for that. There's another issue that comes up here, though, in all of this restaurant discussion, and that is the kalim, the utensils themselves. If it's a Jewish-owned restaurant, then those utensils should be going to mikvah. So what do I do? I'm going into a Jewish-owned, non-kosher restaurant. They're willing to serve me kosher foods by giving me a meal, right? And they're just going to give me their utensils. Or I'm just going to get the salad, but I'm going to use their fork, and I'm going to use their knife, and so on. So take a look at source number 11. The Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in the Code of Jewish Law, says, if one uses a utensil without immersing it, the food is not prohibited. Again, to explain, utensils that are produced or owned by someone who isn't Jewish and then purchased by a Jew are supposed to be brought to the mikvah before they are used. However, if used it, the food is not rendered non-kosher. So there are two different ways this line is taken. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein ruled that even though the food isn't prohibited, I'm not allowed to use it, even if I'm not the owner. So in other words, I'm invited over to another Jew's house. The Jew says, I don't actually keep kosher, but I'm willing to get you kosher food. And then he puts it out there and he gives me his fork and his knife. And he even went to the rabbi and had the rabbi kosher the utensils. But the utensils never took a trip to the mikvah. The result is, where Moshe Feinstein says, I'm not allowed to use the fork and the knife. Yes, they're kosher, but they weren't tovel, they were never immersed. So, according to Rav Moshe, then, I couldn't go to a Jewish-owned restaurant and eat there, even if I got kosher food, because of the utensils. However, other authorities disagree. Rav Yitzchak Weiss, the Menchas Yitzchak, and others argue that the responsibility to immerse the utensils lies with the owner and not with anybody else. So that if I go to the restaurant, the owner is breaking the law, but I am not breaking the law by using the utensils. So there is some debate in that regard. So again, just to make sure to sum up the practical kashrut half of this, the sort of which items can I eat? We're okay with fruits and vegetables, avoiding the buggy ones and avoiding the lemon and avoiding the radishes and the onions. We don't like the fish. We don't like the sushi. The bread, ask your rabbi about hard bread as an option. 100% juice would be okay if it's not apple juice. And then the coffee is subject to debate, but classically the unflavored coffee was fine, ideally in a disposable if possible. Alcohol we're going to have to talk about. And if it's a Jewish-owned restaurant, or Moshe Feinstein would say you can't use their utensils because they didn't go to mikvah. Whenever I talk about this topic, I think of the story of Menachem Begin and Sadat, where when Sadat was visiting from Egypt and came for this whole what became ultimately the Sinai Agreement. So he flew in on Motzai Shabbos, Saturday night. And Begin insisted when they scheduled the visit that he only come after Shabbat. And his statement was, because if we don't show that we respect Shabbos, how can we expect anybody else to? And that was a very important line and a very important sentiment. This has been an issue historically in terms of rulings on what a Jew may and may not do on Shabbos, on Yom Tov, the concern about the message that it will convey to people around us. And I would apply that here as well. If we do expect society around us to honor our halachic concerns, then it's important that we show that those concerns matter to us. That it's not just something that we take lightly or are willing to put aside. So before going into all of these circumstances, the ideal is for the Jew to say, "I keep kosher. I will be glad to participate in your meeting. Please arrange kosher food for me." That's really what ought to happen. In the event that it's not possible, then you have all of these possibilities. Yes.
I thought your comment on Shabbat was going to be a segue into attending conferences on Shabbat, which happens to be the next talk. However, I do have a question on this. It's also a little bit off topic. You work in a hospital, you work in a company, and you bring your own food to work. Under what circumstances can you use the company microwave to reheat your food?
Good question. So the microwaves now take us into another realm, so to speak. The easiest possible approach would be the double wrapping of your food. In other words, if you wrap it in two separate wrappings which don't bleed moisture into each other, so it's not like you have just like saran wrap where it's like it'll just mush together and be one layer. But if you have two distinct layers around it, and you're not going to have passage of air from the microwave into it or out, then you'd be fine heating up your food in that microwave. In the event that that's not possible, and by the way, the dish counts as a layer.
The problem with saran wrap?
No, just that the problem with saran wrap is that it's not two distinct layers. The concept of double wrapping is because we're taught that in Jewish law, there's no absorption between one utensil and another utensil without moisture. So, for example, if I had a pot here with meat food in it and a pot here with dairy food in it, and everything is hot, and the lid from the meat pot fell off and struck the dairy one, I wouldn't have to worry about anything. There's no absorption going back and forth because there's no liquid present. It's just dry utensil hitting dry utensil. So that's the way this double wrap works. Even if there's non-kosher food sitting in the microwave, right? Someone microwaved this food before and spilled on it in the microwave. Nonetheless, anything that's absorbed by the outer layer is not hitting the inner layer, is not getting into the inner layer. So I need two distinct layers. If I use saran wrap as both of my layers, it really just merges together to become one. It doesn't survive as a distinct. Sorry? Because if I have one layer, then let's say you have this person's grease or whatever it is in it. The steam from that grease hits my outer layer and is absorbed in that, and then from there into the food. Because utensils do extrude into food. They just don't extrude into other utensils. You know what I'm saying?
I follow, but I...
You
have a paper bag.
Yeah.
So it goes with grease from the...
Grease to paper bag to food that's inside it.
That's what you're saying.
That's the idea. Whereas if
then
I...
Then another paper, then you...
One layer in. Correct. Correct. One layer in. So if I have two paper bags, then I've solved the problem. I can use the dish that the food is in as part of one layer. If I have the dish, and then I have an upper layer, you know, for the part that isn't covered by the dish, and then I wrap everything in a second thing, then I'm fine.
So that's one layer.
But it's not.
But if you have an enclosed pot.
Yeah.
Well,
here's my closed pot.
Right. If you put a bag.
Oh. I put it in a bag. I'm fine.
That's one. Okay.
That's the idea of two layers. That's what we're trying to get across.
Too, because when you get an airline food, you get double wrap. You get one and two.
Right.
On top of the container.
Yeah, but the container doesn't have a top.
It does have a top.
Styrofoam shell is one way. Saran wrap is the other way.
That's right. Then it works.
You get two foils.
But don't use foil on my grave, please. That would be good. I'm not responsible.
You don't use Saran wrap.
You can use a wrap as one.
Saran wrap in a paper bag.
Right. Yes.
Paper bag is fine. It'll be a separate layer. Yeah.
You mentioned.
Mind you, I'm assuming no moisture. If there's moisture, right? If you see that there's steam between them, then you know, all bets are off. So in other words, if I open up the microwave afterwards and I see that there was moisture that got through to the inner layer, then I have a problem. Because that defeated my double layer. And double layers are not magic, in other words. It's not like, okay, I did a double layer, everything is now fine. The double wrapping works because the moisture is blocked. In the event that it isn't blocked, it didn't work. Yes, Moshe?
You mentioned fruits, vegetables, but you can be at a business meeting and you find out, you say, show me the cottage cheese that you use in the restaurant, and it's under Hampshire, and you take the cold cottage cheese and you eat that, or sour cream, or innumerable number of products, lox, that is coming in the pack from the center of Krishna.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, my assumption was you don't have access to the kitchen, so you can't, you know, investigate and find out what they're doing. But if you're able to investigate and find out that it's kosher, then all you have is the Maris Ayin concern that we mentioned in the beginning, the issue of people understanding or not understanding what it is that you're doing, and you would be responsible to make sure that onlookers will know, I checked this out. Because the person next to you, you're having the cottage cheese. The person next to you is having hard cheese that isn't under Hashir. How does the onlooker know that you investigated the cottage cheese and that the hard cheese isn't okay? So you would, as Rav Moshe said, be responsible to keep yourself innocent in the eyes of others, and you have a wrapper there, you have, you know, whatever it is, to let people know this is separate, this is unique.
I think just from a practical matter, you know, when you're talking about going to the restaurant in the Jewish area, maybe Avimina, you go into a Goyish area, go to small town, they have no hasaga of kashrus or anything to dump you. And even most of the Jews in those areas don't have any concept either. And I traveled small towns all over Quebec and Ontario and Western Canada. You know, you talk to them about this, it's like you're from Mars.
Right.
So,
no, it's true. And a lot depends on the reality you're talking about. Yes?
Sorry, I got two comments. One is that it's nice that we're talking about all these kosher meals to all these young people, but they don't know that 30 years ago, 35 years ago, if you had a business meeting, there was no such thing as order.
Correct. Right.
The second goes back to the beginning. It's a good story. I heard a friend of mine was at the hockey game right after they got the kosher hot dogs factory in Toronto. If you haven't been to a Toronto hockey game yet, you can get kosher hot dogs. A few months after he was at the game, somebody came up to him and asked him for mechila because he said, I saw you eating a hot dog at a hockey game. I said, how can you eat that hot dog at the hockey game? Didn't realize there was a kosher.
There you go. Well, I'm glad he asked afterwards.
Same question.
But it's very true. It's very true that the reality today is different on many fronts. And a lot of what we're talking about is reality-based. It's not about the halacha being one way 30 years ago and another way today. It's the same halacha, but you have to establish what's going on at the fish counter today, what's going on in the restaurants today, and based on that, determine the practice. Yes?
So let's say they tell you they're using triple-washed lettuce. Can we rely on that if it doesn't have an etching?
So my experience in using triple-washed lettuce has been that when it's been, number one, if it's been organic, or number two, it's been one of the curlier leaves, like a green leaf lettuce, I've still found stuff. Not a lot, but it's definitely there. Now, I'm talking about stuff from supermarkets, not stuff in restaurants. I don't know if that's any different. But again, it's a practical question. It's a question of what's in front of you. I mean, theoretically, it's possible for you to get a salad with baby greens, and you can look at the leaves that are in front of you. It's not like it's rocket science to look for bugs. If you have good eyes, you know, you can look at it on your plate and see it for yourself. I don't know if you want to do that at the table with everybody else. You know, you may be better off not eating. But you know, it's a mitzvah question. It's a question of just what are the facts on the ground, so to speak. Yes?
Another possible issue also with respect to China, that issue of dishwasher making the church making a pope. In that case,
right. So that's a major question, is whether dishwasher soap, whether the detergent they use, actually does render the taste flawed or not. And it depends likely on what type of a soap they're actually using. If they're using an industrial cleanser, the sort of thing that no one should ever be eating, then the answer is yes, it could flaw it. But that isn't always the case. Yeah, again, it's a matter of knowing what we're talking about. But that's part of the Starbucks debate. Is this debate about the effect of the detergent? Thank you very much. Next week we shift gears to talk about tzedakah calculations and what's deductible. There should be a mention. That sounds good to me. That's the debate.